Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the resignation of Rob Porter, the rising star in the White House, who was dating Hope Hicks, the young woman who spends more time with Donald Trump than any other aide. Although his history of spousal abuse was known, it was not acted upon until a picture of the first battered wife appeared, followed by testimony from the second, who claimed he called her an effing bitch on their honeymoon. Then a third woman, an ex-girlfriend working in the Trump administration, came forward recently and told the White House counsel Porter had abused her as well as his ex-wives. Dahlia Lithwick, a senior editor and legal correspondent for Slate, where she has an article, Rob Porter's History of Domestic Abuse Wasn't a Secret, It's Just That No One Cared, joins us. We will discuss how Porter's boss, General Kelly, after defending Porter and praising him effusively, has not just been exposed as a hardline ideologue and hardly the adult in the room everyone was hoping for, but the military disciplinarian is showing signs he is not diminishing the chaos at the White House, but instead is adding to the incompetence. Then, after Nancy Pelosi's eight-hour-long defense of the Dreamers before the House yesterday, we will assess what strategies the House minority can employ against a majority of Republicans who are anti-immigrant and a White House that is stirring up xenophobic and nativist anger. We will speak with Margaret Hugh, a professor of law at Washington and Lee Law School. She served as special policy counsel in the Office of Special Counsel for Immigration at the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department, and we will discuss how Democrats can leverage the threat of a government shutdown to achieve their goals without repeating the mistakes of the recent government shutdown. Then finally, we will speak with one of the nation's leading experts on intelligence organizations, Locke Johnson, the author of a timely new book, Spy Watching: Intelligence Accountability in the United States. He was staff director of the Senate Committee on Intelligence and was at the forefront of the reforms that brought about the House and Senate Intelligence Oversight Committees, and we will discuss how Trump's stooge, Devin Nunes, the chair of the House Intelligence Committee, is single-handedly wrecking his committee and destroying the bipartisanship that is essential in protecting our national security. And joining us now is Dahlia Lithwick, who's a senior editor and legal correspondent for Slate, where she writes the columns Supreme Court Dispatches and Jurisprudence. She also hosts the podcast Amicus, and her latest article at Slate is Rob Porter's History of Domestic Abuse Wasn't a Secret, It's Just That No One Cared. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dahlia Lithwick.
Thank you for having me back, Ian.
Well, thank you, Dahlia. And let's start with the White House Chief of Staff, John Kelly, who was previously head of Homeland Security. When he was brought in to be Chief of Staff after Reince Priebus was fired, there was a sense that, oh, good, we got another adult in the room along with McMaster and Mattis, the generals. But it seems like he went under the radar a little as the kind of hardline ideologue that he really is. And more, he seems to be exhibiting signs not just of being a kind of nativist and totally in sync with Donald Trump, his boss, as opposed to trying to contain and restrain him, but he also seems like he may be also incompetent.
Yeah, I mean, he's had a really bad week. You know, I think it would have been bad enough if he hadn't implied that the Dreamers who didn't sign up under DACA were lazy. That was a misstep. And then instead of saying, I shouldn't have said that, he doubled down and you know, re-upped that was what he really meant. And then this situation with Rob Porter, where, again, I think he had ample opportunity to say, I didn't mean to, you know, impugn the integrity of the women who reported abuse. I didn't mean to say what I said. Instead, double down and double down again. And so I think there is a way. Maybe it's the siege mentality that when you feel that everybody is in a conspiracy to get you and to show weakness, to admit you made a mistake, is to empower the other side. I can't quite figure out why repeatedly this week, given the opportunity to fix errors, he has refused to do so. It must have at bottom something to do with not wanting to show weakness and not wanting to show weakness to a president who only prizes never backing down.
Well, both Chief of Staff General Kelly and Orrin Hatch, who Rob Porter used to work for, both came out of the gate with effusive praise for Rob Porter, as though he walked on water. And it seems like it was only when the photograph of the first ex-wife of Porter's with a black eye seems to have changed the narrative, to the point now, of course, where the White House spokesman Raj Shah said today that we could have done better. So that is, I guess, when you say they don't, you know, they're all in the following the Frank Sinatra playbook. They never apologize, right? But in this case, that was a kind of tacit or lame apology. So what is your sense then of whether or not they can weather this in terms of there's the Me Too movement that's out there. There's a, you know, one of Trump's closest friends, Steve Wynn, just lost his job, both at, as the finance chair of the RNC, but also as the head of his multi-billion-dollar corporation. So there's something happening out there, and it does seem like John Kelly and I assume by extension Donald Trump are out of step with it. Is it going to, I mean, he's so far Donald Trump, you have to admit, he's gotten away with paying off a porn star and having about 12 women attack him and accuse him of sexual harassment and going on video for the whole world to hear that he is a celebrity. And one of the great benefits of being a celebrity is you can grab women by the private parts and get away with it. So when's he going to be pulled over by the Me Too movement?
You know, it's interesting. I think there's this causation question, which is, would the Me Too movement have even begun but for Donald Trump? And I think, you know, in the most concrete way, you know, that Access Hollywood video you're referring to really was sort of the beginning of women starting to say, here's my story, here's my story. And then it reaches, you know, a real zenith around the Harvey Weinstein allegations. But I think that there is some reason to think that a lot of Me Too is women experiencing a deep and resonant sense that what they're watching happen with Donald Trump is something that triggers a memory, you know, sometimes a really, you know, embarrassing personal intimate memory, or sometimes something that women brushed away and said, oh, you know, this is just the world we live in. And I think that there is some reason to believe that the more Donald Trump chooses to be blind to that, the more you're going to have what we saw in Alabama with Roy Moore, where, you know, it turns out you can't, even as Donald Trump, endorse and support somebody, you know, who has multiple credible allegations of child sexual impropriety. There is a line at which voters will say, I don't feel that I want to go there. And I think that that was Alabama. And I think that that is Rob Porter. And so I do think that whether it's causal or not, the fact that the Trump view of the world continues to be never apologize, never admit, never surrender, just move on, I think is starting to lose whatever salience it has. I think certainly among women, I think it's fairly evident that women don't accept that you can continue to treat people like this or surround yourself with people who treat women like this and get a pass. But I think more pointedly, we're really starting to see women, and I think this is, for me, the under kind of semi-underside of the Rob Porter story, women who feel that, look, I complained. You know, I went to my church, I went to a counselor, I reported this to family, I told the FBI during a clearance, you know, check. I thought that once John Kelly knew about this, something was going to happen. And at every turn, the system failed to hold him accountable. And I think that what's really profoundly different now, and this I think transcends Me Too, is women starting to say, well, if the system cannot, the formal legal system, hold men to account, then I really do have to be activated. I'm going to have to figure something out. And I think that that's not just women, by the way. I think that's people across the boards. And so you are going to have some fraction, I think, of the population who still thinks that Donald Trump is a wizard and speaks truth to power, and that women are snowflakes and they should stay in their place. But I think of the 30-whatever percent of voters who were ambivalent or conflicted or confused or not engaged in this conversation when they voted for Donald Trump, I think every day that goes by that they don't reckon with that is a day that they lose voters. You cannot see what happened with Rob Porter, I think, and be ambivalent anymore.
And Dahlia Lithwick, in your article at Slate, Rob Porter's history of domestic abuse wasn't a secret. It's just that no one cared. You point out that he's very much a golden boy, a Rhodes Scholar, Harvard, son of a prominent academic. And I didn't know that he'd been dating Hope Hicks. Previously, she was dating Corey, what's his name, Lewandowski, right?
She's having quite a run. Yep.
Uh-huh. So this is the handsome guy that's in the White House. Are they still an item? I don't mean to sound too tabloidy here, but...
Well, the Daily Mail reported in their original reporting around Rob Porter, they were the first, I think, to break the story that they were dating. And so it's not too tabloidy because I think this was a story broken, by a pretty tabloidy enterprise. And the last I've seen is that, I don't know if they're still dating, nobody's made a public statement, but I do know that the statement that initially released supporting him was in part written by Hope Hicks. And that's just unbelievable. Yeah. I mean, it tells you how strange a world we live in where, former accusers of domestic violence are coming forward to report against someone and his current girlfriend is helping message it. And it's, in a way it goes to how small and weird and incestuous the world of the White House is. But it also, I think, goes to this question of, who at the White House is the adult? I mean, if John Kelly is meant to be the adult in the room and his response is, I stand by him and he's an honorable man and I'm honored to serve with him, and only after really horrifying photographs emerge to distance himself, then if that's what the adults in the room are saying, who are the real adults? And I think that, I say this as the mother of children and just as a woman in this world, the idea that you would ask adults to support victims and have the adults instead denigrate them, mm-hmm. I think is just a really terrifying lesson for vulnerable people of any ilk.
Well, some people are terrified by the fact that Donald Trump spends most of the day with a 28-year-old former model as his number one advisor and closest confidant, which is in itself a little strange. But the hypocrisy is so glaring. They have gone to town on the FBI agent and his girlfriend and their correspondents to build this case of a secret society within the deep state. And they were basically a couple exchanging emails, and now you have a couple inside the White House. Let's get a hold of their texts and emails, can we?
Well, I think it's, I don't want to read their texts and emails, and I also don't want to condemn, couples.
People are entitled to have fall in love with whoever they. I'm not the love police here.
No, I know, but I think it was wrong of the Justice Department even to throw the FBI couple under the bus and to reveal all their texts. I think that was an incredibly strategic and actually an ethical error to sort of throw all that out to be hashed over. But I think to your point, Ian, the fact that very recently we had Republicans trashing Hillary Clinton for failing to fire somebody who was later accused of improper behavior and going after her for her friendship with Harvey Weinstein, and then saying, oh, this guy who's actually got security clearance in the Oval Office and who apparently was handling every document that the president saw and who couldn't get the highest levels of security clearance because we all knew he had a history of domestic violence, that's not a problem that we covered for him. I mean, that's the hypocrisy that kind of blows my mind.
Right, and the other person who can't get this high security clearance in the White House is Jared Kushner. But just in closing, it feels like you need two women in this world. If you go back to the hearings for the Supreme Court Justice Thomas, you recall Anita Hill was hung out to dry. There was a second witness who didn't show. It's some confusion about why that happened. Joe Biden did talk about it recently. But the long and the short of it is, is that what it takes? You got to have one woman with a black eye, and then that's the first wife, and then the second wife verifies everything and more, because it sounds like he was pretty dreadful to her as well.
Yeah, in my piece today, I quoted Catherine McKinnon, who's a iconic professor at Michigan. And she had an amazing piece in the New York Times last Sunday where she described, in the context of why the legal protections that are meant to exist for women continue to fail women. And she said, when she was looking at campus rape allegations, she said, quote, it typically took 3 to 4 women testifying that they had been violated by the same man in the same way to even begin to make a dent in his denial. And she goes on to say that made a woman, for credibility purposes, 1/4 of a person. And I think that that's exactly what you're saying. You know, you needed 4, 5, 6 people to come, to say that Clarence Thomas had done what Anita Hill was alleging, and you're quite right. Joe Biden did not call those other people who would have made one whole person. But I do think that is exactly the pattern we saw playing out with Rob Porter. We had both ex-wives who had told the FBI a long time ago and had told other people a long time ago, and then a third woman who came forward anonymously and talked to Don McGahn, White House counsel, about her experience with him, and that 3/4 of a person apparently didn't amount to enough that the White House took it seriously or that John Kelly felt that he could take those claims seriously. So I think we're still tragically in Anita Hill's world where unless there are more than 4 of you, you better find a posse because you're not going to be credited with telling the truth. And, that isn't an argument for witch hunts or for, believe everyone. It's an argument for why can't we think as systemically and respectfully of a woman's rights as we think of the accused rights. And we're just failing on that front dismally right now.
Well, Dahlia Lithwick, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Dahlia Lithwick, who's a senior editor and legal correspondent for Slate, where she writes the columns Supreme Court Dispatches and Jurisprudence. She also hosts the podcast Amicus, and her latest article at Slate is Rob Porter's History of Domestic Abuse Wasn't a Secret, It's Just That No One Cared. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into how Democrats can leverage the threat of a government shutdown to achieve their goals without repeating the mistakes of the recent government shutdown.